From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, in light of the terrorist attacks in France, a look at anti-Semitism in that nation.
The situation is very difficult, and the reality is most people in the Jewish community, what just happened is not really a surprise.
Hackers gain access to the social media sites of the U.S. Central Command. The U.S. and Pakistan review economic, security, and stabilization goals. And the IAEA announces a new project under their Peaceful Uses Initiative. I'm Susan Yawkey. Washington has admitted it erred in not sending a top official to attend the Solidarity Rally in France Sunday. At a news conference, White House spokesman Josh Earnest spoke about the decision to have U.S. Ambassador to France Jane Hartley and the State Department's top diplomat for Europe, Victoria Nuland, as the highest-ranking American officials to join scores of world leaders alongside French President François Hollande.
I think it's fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile to be there.
Earlier Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry dismissed criticism that neither he nor other top officials traveled to Paris.
I don't think the people of France have any doubt about America's understanding of what happened, about our personal sense of loss, and our deep commitment to the people of France in this moment of trial.
Secretary Kerry added that the U.S. has been deeply engaged and has been sharing intelligence with France from the moment the attack took place. The terrorist attacks in France included a deadly hostage drama at a kosher grocery store. Four people and a hostage taker were killed there. We spoke about the incident with Simone Rodin Benzaquin, director of the American Jewish Committee office in Paris.
The attacker came into the supermarket, killed immediately three victims, and then held hostage several others for several hours. He had a phone conversation with several media, so his motivations were sort of explained, in which he says that he was avenging Muslims all over the world. It was actually a mixture of avenging Muslims, we have to leave us alone, there will be many others who will come. He also said that the reason why he did it is that the French did not save the people in Syria. It was sort of a mixture of unclear things, and he was then the police made an assault a few hours later and killed him. He had in the meantime he had unfortunately the time to kill another victim who tried to grab a gun, which didn't work, and he killed him.
Is this believed directly related to it being a kosher grocery store?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. The motivations are clearly anti-Semitic. The police have really clearly stated it. It is really in the context of a succession of events and in the context of a growing jihadi threat against Jews here in France. The president has immediately, President Hollande has immediately spoken out and said very, very clearly that this is an anti-Semitic attack directed against the Jewish community. There's no single doubt about it.
How bad is the state of anti-Semitism in France?
The situation is very difficult, and the reality is, to most people in the Jewish community, what just happened is not really a surprise. It is sort of another attack of a series of attacks that happened over the past years. You might remember that only 2.5 years ago, the terrorist Mohamed Merah killed Jewish school children in the southern city of France in Toulouse. We've had an increase of anti-Semitic acts of about 90% last year. The anti-Semitic acts that are violent are also becoming more and more increasing. We had, in terms of violent anti-Semitic acts, we had an increase of 124%. So it's really in the context of a larger situation that is extremely dangerous for the Jewish community and very, very worrying.
Are more French Jews leaving France because of their treatment there?
For a very long time, the numbers of French Jews leaving to Israel was between 2,000 to 3,000 Jews a year. This year, we've really hit a record of French Jews who left to Israel. We had 7,000 French Jews this year. It is expected that next year there will be about 10,000 with this event. Who knows, there can be many more. It also, this number doesn't take into consideration those who left to other countries, to the United States, to Canada, and other European countries. The situation is very, very serious, and there are obviously, I mean, those who are leaving, but there are many others who stay, and those who stay ask themselves the question whether they have a viable future in this country.
Well, what can and should be done to improve the treatment of Jews in France?
We at the AJC and also from the French Jewish community have alerted the government for a very, very, very long time. There are many things, I believe, that can be done. First of all, security measures need to be taken in order to protect Jewish sites. There was already an increased security, but much more needs to be done. The President Hollande and the Minister of Interior have announced that they have deployed a plan where the army will now protect a certain number of Jewish sites. This could have probably been done before. Then there needs to be done very, very clear program on counter-radicalization, something that has not existed sufficiently, I believe, in France. There needs to be work that needs to be done in prisons. We have a huge problem of radicalization in our prisons. There needs to be thinking about whether to separate those who are potentially radicalizers of others. We need to be doing much more work on hate speech and radicalization methods on the internet and social media in particular. We know now that out of the 1,000 French fighters who were involved in Syria or in Iraq, many of them have actually become radicalized on the internet. So much more needs to be done on that one. And then finally, we need to be doing much more in terms of education in our schools. Young children need to learn about tolerance, about democracy, about other religions, if we want to make sure that this is not going to happen again.
Simone Rodin Benzaquin, director of the American Jewish Committee office in Paris. Hackers claiming to support Islamic State militants Monday were able to gain access to the social media sites of U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in 20 countries across South and Central Asia and the Middle East, including airstrikes aimed at IS positions in Iraq and Syria. They posted threatening messages and propaganda videos, as well as military documents. The Pentagon says while the accounts were compromised for about 30 minutes, no sensitive or classified information was accessed. It views the incident as a case of cyber vandalism, but the Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into the matter. Cedric Layton is a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, now operates his own risk management and consulting firm. He was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty how serious he believes the breach was.
Well, it's certainly concerning from the standpoint of the fact that it impacts the message that CENTCOM is trying to send out to the Middle East, because both the English language Twitter feed of CENTCOM and the Arabic language Twitter feed of CENTCOM were hacked. Now, the key thing to know about this is that it did not affect the actual CENTCOM networks. This was solely the Twitter and YouTube accounts that are actually managed by those respective services. So the hackers did not get into the actual networks, either the unclassified or the classified networks of CENTCOM. They did not have access to true operational details or any data of that type. The data that was posted appeared to have been old data, but it was made to look as if it was relevant to operations that are ongoing at this moment. That does not appear to be the case. So it is an attempt to intimidate. It is a psychological effort, part of a psychological warfare campaign by the Islamic State or people that support the Islamic State. And it should be looked at as a serious issue, but it is not a grave threat to the national security of the United States.
Is it a precursor to something where hackers could drill deeper into CENTCOM's computer network?
It's a remote potential that could happen through a Twitter or YouTube feed. But those networks are actually separated from the classified networks and the ones that are used for operational planning. So that possibility, while it exists, is remote at this point.
Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas, who is chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security called it severely disturbing. Quote, assaults from cyber jihadists will become more common unless the Obama administration develops a strategy for appropriately responding to these cyber attacks, including those like the North Korea attack against Sony Pictures.
There are certainly areas for concern here, and any time a Twitter account or a YouTube account is hacked, that shows that there are weaknesses within those respective services, and means that everything should be tightened according to basic authentication procedures and other things that can be done to assure the identity of the users of those accounts. But having said that, the key thing is that there has to be a differentiation between what happened with CENTCOM's Twitter account and the YouTube account versus what happened in the Sony hacking case. And those are two distinct issues. In the Sony case, the network of Sony was actually attacked, actually rendered useless and inoperable. And that is a much more severe impact than what occurred in the case of the CENTCOM Twitter account.
Layden says this latest hacking represents an evolving form of warfare in the 21st century, providing both state and non-state actors an asymmetrical advantage over their adversaries. He says such attacks will unfortunately become more commonplace over the next decade. Speaking to the Washington Post, Peter Singer, a strategist and analyst with the New American Foundation in Washington, says the hacking amounts to a public relations victory for IS, even if it was not directly involved. Embarrassing the U.S. government is a feather in their cap in terms of pulling off something that other groups have not been able to do, he said.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has praised the progress made by Pakistan's military in its fight against militants in the country's northwest. His comments came in Islamabad, where U.S. and Pakistani officials have discussed shared goals on trade, economic development, and counterterrorism at a strategic dialogue session. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reports.
As they sat across from each other in a large room flanked by their advisors, Secretary of State John Kerry and Pakistani National Security Advisor Sartaj Aziz outlined progress the two countries had made through cooperation on projects in five areas: energy, economic growth, community stabilization, education, and health. They also announced the establishment of a sixth working group that will deal with science and technology. Kerry said since the last strategic dialogue convened, the U.S. and Pakistan had focused on expanding bilateral investment and trade.
Annual two-way commerce has already reached more than $5 billion, and the United States is now, today, Pakistan's largest export market.
He also said the partnership between the U.S. and Pakistan had to reflect the interconnectedness of the region, and that included finding avenues of cooperation between Pakistan and India and working together to support security and stability in Afghanistan.
The recent visit to Kabul by two of Pakistan's top military officers and the head of its intelligence service are extremely encouraging signs of what I hope will be a new era in the relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Later, during a joint news conference with Kerry, Aziz said Pakistan wants peaceful relations with its neighbors, both on its eastern and western borders.
We hope, therefore, that U.S., as an influential member of the international community, can prevail upon India to work with Pakistan towards regional peace and economic prosperity.
He also said that during the strategic dialogue talks, the U.S. and Pakistan agreed that peace and stability in Afghanistan is a prerequisite for stability in Pakistan and the region. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Islamabad.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has announced a new project under the Peaceful Uses Initiative. They say it will provide high-quality training and cutting-edge equipment based on molecular biology to help virologists in 11 African countries more quickly and safely diagnose emerging diseases such as Ebola. The United States has contributed $1 million to help fund the project. Michael Warnow heads the Africa section of the IAEA's Department of Technical Cooperation. He explains to VOA's Kim Lewis how molecular biology will help doctors diagnose Ebola more quickly.
The techniques supporting and transferring in the member states is called RT-PCR, so it's a reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction. And this technique is amplifying the genetic material of pathogens and allows identifying the virus, for instance, in the case of the Ebola virus.
What type of training will be provided through the funding?
So in this project, we will be training virologists to first use the methodology, so the RT-PCR, to identify pathogen. And in the particular case of this very dangerous zoonotic diseases, so this disease that can be transferred from animals to human, we will be also training them to work in high safety working conditions.
When will the training start and how long does it take?
The project is just starting now. We just received information about the funding of this part of the project, so we are initiating the implementation of the project right now. We'll start by a coordination meeting with a world expert in these molecular biology techniques, and the training will be starting as soon as possible. In fact, they will be discussed during this coordination meeting that by now is planned to be held on the third week of February. So hopefully we could start the trainings in March or April of this year.
I understand there are 11 African countries that will be involved in this project. So what countries are you going to start first?
First, you have to know that this project we're speaking about is a project that is, it's an activity that is proposed under the Peaceful Uses Initiative of the IAEA, but it's only part of our activity. So it's part of a broader project that aims at strengthening the capacity of the African region in detecting emerging zoonotic diseases in wildlife and livestock in order to be able to anticipate the risk of outbreak in the human population. So by now, this first activity is targeting 11 countries that are the countries, let's say, most at risk, either because they are affected by the Ebola virus or because they are bordering these countries or from the road traffic or air traffic. But in a second time, in the broader project, all the African countries are targeted as participating countries.
What type of equipment will be needed and where will this come from?
The type of equipment we are dealing with in this case are RT-PCR machines. So there's machines that allow detecting the DNA, the genetic material of viruses or the pathogens. And this equipment are in fact from companies. Many companies are selling it on the market. And so we are developing some methodologies using this equipment, especially in our joint division between FAO and the IAEA, to diagnose animal disease.
What is the advantage of using molecular biology to diagnose infectious diseases?
These techniques have huge advantage of sensitivity and rapidity. So most of the classical techniques can take several days before you are able to identify a pathogen. And in this case, in using this RT-PCR, we are speaking about a few hours, let's say a half day to identify, to analyze several tens of samples. They are also, by now, at least to the best of my knowledge, the only methodologies that are validated, so in which you can actually identify the virus.
Once this project is completed, how many virologists would you say will be trained and prepared to use the molecular biology equipment?
In the first part of the project, we are targeting, as you said, 11 countries, and in each of these countries, we are planning to have a team of 4 to 5 virologists fully trained to these techniques. In this particular case, of course, because we are dealing here with an emerging zoonotic disease of high risk. So we already have many people because these activities, we are performing them in the countries, in the member states of the IAEA for a long time. So many people are trained by now, but for more less dangerous diseases, let's say.
Michael Warnow, head of the Africa section of the IAEA, speaking with us from Vienna. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 13th, 1832, American novelist Horatio Alger was born. Alger wrote more than 100 novels, mostly about young boys living in poverty and managing to find success and prosperity by working hard and never giving up. Many successful men in the early 20th century claimed Alger's books were important in inspiring them in their early years. In 1842, Dr. William Brydon, a doctor serving with the British East India Company Army during the First Anglo-Afghan War, became famous for being the only person to reach safety in Jalalabad. Brydon was with a force of more than 16,000 that retreated from the capital, Kabul, and then were massacred or kidnapped by Afghan tribesmen as they fled. On this day in 1910, American inventor Lee DeForest broadcast a live performance of Enrico Caruso from the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. The broadcast could be heard only by a small number of electronics hobbyists, but by 1915, DeForest was broadcasting regular nightly concerts, increasing interest in the new communications medium, radio.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend.
And on this day in 1968, Johnny Cash gave a concert at Folsom State Prison in Northern California. The album recorded at the prison became a big hit in the United States and by 2003 had sold 3 million copies. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the prime goals of the Global Health Initiative, President Barack Obama's signature program, is to improve the quality of the lives of women and girls. And what better way to start than by reducing the number of deaths among mothers and newborns? In low- and middle-income countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, childbirth and the 48 hours around it are one of the most vulnerable times for a mother and baby. Every year, 289,000 women die in pregnancy or of pregnancy-related complications. 2.9 million newborns die, and 2.6 million babies are stillborn. That is why, 3 years ago, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, launched the Saving Lives at Birth, a Grand Challenge for Development initiative, a global partnership between USAID, the Government of Norway, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the nonprofit Grand Challenges Canada, the U.K.'s Department for International Development, and the World Bank. The initiative serves to encourage the development of creative and innovative solutions with regard to medical treatment, prevention, and technologies that have the capacity to reduce infant and maternal mortality around the time of birth. In less than 4 years, the Grand Challenge for Development has funded 81 innovations that help improve the survival chances of new mothers and their infants. In fact, the initiative is so promising that the Saving Lives at Birth partners recently announced that they aim to make a new commitment to invest up to another $50 million. Thus, over the next 5 years, the additional funding will accelerate and expand Saving Lives at Birth's investment into groundbreaking, sustainable projects that will help save the lives of pregnant women and their infants in some of the hardest-to-reach corners of the world. Saving Lives at Birth has mobilized the world's brightest thinkers, researchers, and entrepreneurs around the critical issue of maternal and newborn health, said USAID Administrator Dr. Rajiv Shah. During the next stage of this challenge, we aim to put an even greater focus on sourcing and accelerating innovations that significantly expand our reach to families around the world. Saving the lives of mothers and children, one of the best investments we can make.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.